The World in Words
is made possible in part
by the National Endowment for the Humanities,
celebrating 50 years of excellence.
Nina.
Hey, Patrick.
Give a listen to this.
Okay.
Hi. Can you say blueberry?
Pepper.
Can you say cheese?
Cheese.
Can you say nuts?
Nuts.
How about more?
Can you say more?
Who is that? Is that your daughter?
That's my daughter, my wife.
Adorable.
Yeah, from quite a few years ago.
Her emphasis on more was very, she really liked that word.
She always loved to say more. She didn't even know what she was saying more to, but just more.
Yeah.
We took as all new parents do, we took like a ton of videos of her, especially tried to sort of document a little bit of how she was acquiring language. Just not from a kind of particularly academic standpoint, but just because
we... From a parental one.
Yeah, I mean, it was kind of a miraculous thing to watch.
I bet it is.
And I can't say that I really understand it any more now than I did before. You know, it was a thing of wonder.
Well, think about that even on a bigger scale. Like, it's amazing and a miracle that humans have language at all.
Yeah, and that is the topic of the show this week. Where does language come from?
How do humans learn to speak? Why did humans learn to speak?
Good thing we got someone here to explain it all to us, Nina.
Yes.
Our colleague Ari Daniel with our partner program Nova. Hi, Ari.
Hey, Ari.
Hi, Patrick. Hi, Nina. So I thought we'd get started in Providence, Rhode Island, in the living room of a rather well-appointed home in a residential area of town. It belongs to octogenarian, I haven't written that word in a script before, belongs to octogenarian Philip Lieberman, evolutionary biologist and professor emeritus at Brown University.
The title actually is George Hazard Crooker University Professor Emeritus, so the work sort of straddled a number of fields.
Including anatomy.
Okay.
Lieberman is opening up a collection of plastic bags and carefully lifting out hunks of soft white silicone the size of baseballs.
Here's an adult human.
These are casts of vocal tracts, the airways and cavities filling the mouth and nose.
Wait a minute, Ari. I'm still, okay, baseballs, but I still don't have a clear picture of what we're looking at here. What do they look like exactly?
Right. So imagine I took a wad of cotton candy and, forgive me here, but I push it into your mouth and stuff it all the way down your throat and put so much cotton candy in your mouth that it backs up into your nasal passages.
That sounds deeply uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Maybe I shouldn't have asked.
Really
yeah, you're the one that wanted more of a description here. So it's only a thought exercise, but if you could then somehow relocate all that cotton candy that's bunched up inside your mouth and your throat and your nose and were to relocate that cotton candy out onto this table in front of us and keep it in that same shape that it had been in your mouth and nose and throat, that's what these casts look like, just out of silicone. It's basically all the negative space in that part of your head that's usually filled with air. The guy who made them took the heads of frozen cadavers, cut them in half, and stuffed the passageways with silicone.
Used them as molds for the airway.
Lieberman admits the technique's gruesome, but the result is a set of oddly beautiful forms, 3D shapes of where our words come from.
So half of our tongue is sitting down our throat.
Lieberman points out the crucial split in the throat, one path leading to the esophagus and the stomach, the other leading to the larynx or voice box.
So to get food, sort of an acrobatic maneuver you do each time to bounce the food so it goes here and not here.
That is down the esophagus and not down the larynx.
Yeah, and if you get in the larynx, you're in deep trouble. We're the only animals on Earth that have a common pathway for food, liquid, and air, which allows us basically to choke to death.
Wait a second. Is that really true? So humans are the only creatures that can choke to death? So dogs can't choke, or cats, or I don't know.
That's right. Bats. Lambs. None
cows.
Of them.
Nothing? Really?
Nothing. Not koalas. Yeah, I confirmed it with the Smithsonian website. We're the only mammal that can choke on its own food, that can't breathe and swallow at the same time.
Because of the way our throats are set up, the larynx and the esophagus are set up.
That's right. So, and this brings us to the question, why would we ever develop such an odd kind of plumbing? One that would, with a single cursed swallow, hasten our demise.
You'd have no reason for this crazy airway unless speech was being already used.
Meaning that in order for us to evolve a throat that can kill us, there'd have to be something beneficial about that throat that outweighs the possibility of death by choking. That something, thinks Lieberman, was speech. He argues that the geometry and position of our tongues in our throats are what allow us to produce the sounds E and oo. He holds up another silicone cast.
Yeah, I think this is the Neanderthal.
The Neanderthal, a species we diverged from 500,000 years ago that went extinct about 40,000 years ago.
They lived in this extremely harsh climate. It was very cold. They clearly had clothes. In fact, they had controlled use of fires.
For a long time, we just assumed that Neanderthals were these mute brutes. Classic dum-dum caveman idea.
Chris Keneally is a journalist and author who focuses on, among other things, the evolution of language.
Over time, that picture became harder and harder to sustain.
They made flutes.
So Neanderthals had music.
They used beads.
Neanderthals had art and culture. They had clothing. They had weaponry.
And according to some, they had language. The silicone vocal tract of the Neanderthal that Philip Lieberman just showed me resembles a 5-year-old human child, which is to say that it doesn't have the full-on could-be-lethal split in the throat that an adult human has, but it's way closer to it than a chimp or gorilla is. The gradual emergence of the structures that gave us, Homo sapiens, the ability to produce all manner of consonants and vowels parallels what Lieberman and others believe to be the gradual emergence of language in the hominid line.
We didn't go from not having any language to having this extremely complex system of sounds and syntax and words that we have today. There had to be probably many intermediary stages based on how incredibly similar we were with Neanderthals. So close, you know, we could mate and create a hybrid that they must have had at least some kind of rudimentary language.
Philip Lieberman offers another indication to prove the point, Neanderthal weaponry. Sharp-edged stone tools made using a particular technique whereby you chip away at the edges of a stone until you have something that looks like a turtle shell, domed on top and flat on the bottom. When you then strike the stone at just the right place, you fracture off a sharp and sizable flake.
And out pops a tool.
A series of unrelated steps that produces a distinct result.
There's no way this is going to be communicated without language.
Not even through observation?
Hmm?
You couldn't just observe the steps and replicate them?
Well, you could observe and said, why would someone even think of bothering to watch unless someone told them what's the end product's going to be?
Lieberman sees the execution of a complex, multi-step process as evidence for language. He imagines one Neanderthal telling another the Neanderthal equivalent of, this is how you make a sharp spear point, and the other sticking around, watching all the chipping away of the rock and the sudden materialization of the very tool they were promised.
Can you imagine what a Neanderthal might have sounded like?
Yeah, you're not going to have the vowels, E and U. Probably some nasal hyphen going on because of the morphology.
Here Lieberman's doing an impression for me.
It's not going to be as clear, but they could talk.
In the film Iceman, Lieberman voice coached the actor playing the Neanderthal.
Found a damn Neanderthal.
That the actor doing this had to practice for months to do this.
Okay, so the actor practiced for months to scream? I'm sorry.
I think it's a little more nuanced than that, Nina. It's not quite a scream.
Right.
But yeah, that's a good point. What would those months be taken up learning?
Well, Lieberman told me that the director kept adding dialogue to the movie, which required more time working with the actor to get the Neanderthal lines just right. And Lieberman met the guy at a New York hotel to do the voice coaching.
Okay, but the question that remains is, how the heck did he even know what a Neanderthal sounds like to begin with?
Well, Lieberman and a colleague used a computer to model the vocal tract of a Neanderthal.
Okay.
Yeah, I realize it's not the Stanislavski method, but...
Hardly. Okay, but I feel like we're getting a little bit ahead of ourselves. First of all, we don't even know for sure that Neanderthals could talk.
Right. We've got no evidence whatsoever. There's just this circumstantial stuff, like, you know, molds and tools and things like that. No tapes.
No tapes.
You're not impressed.
I don't know. The jury is out, Ari.
All right. Well, you know, what you're asking for is impossible to give you. It's one of the inherent challenges with this whole question of the evolution of language. Here's Chris Keneally again.
You cannot find fossils of the spoken word. The spoken word disappears almost as soon as it is uttered.
At this point, I have to bring up Noam Chomsky. He's the world-renowned linguist at MIT, now emeritus. He has been a pivotal figure in modern linguistics, and his views have defined the orthodoxy of the field. He's the one behind the term universal grammar, which is the theory that the language ability in humans is innate. Chomsky effectively shut down inquiry into language evolution for decades by declaring that language must have emerged suddenly in Homo sapiens without anything leading up to it.
So he doesn't think that Neanderthals spoke at all.
No, not Neanderthals, nothing else. The ability to speak, it's wired into human beings alone.
For a long time, language somehow didn't seem to be considered to be part of that world of evolution. In fact, for a time, it was the intellectual fashion to think that it was actually a stupid question. And in some circles, it was considered kind of taboo because you could never actually know. So what was the point of asking?
But the chorus of people standing up to Chomsky, asking the question and attempting to answer it has steadily grown. For instance, here's what Dan Everett, a cognitive scientist at Bentley University, has to say about Chomsky's ideas.
Not only false, but it's an aberration in the history of the study of languages.
Ooh, that's Chomsky's nemesis, isn't it?
Yes, and more on him in a minute. Everett isn't alone. A bunch of linguists I talk to agree that language evolved gradually in hominids.
But what about Chomsky again? What does he think about the evolutionary theory?
I asked him over email, and here's what he said in essence, that language evolution has nothing to support it beyond assertion.
Yeah, that's exactly what we've been saying, right?
Right.
There's no evidence, there's no tapes. These are all just theories that are going to be impossible to prove. Sounds like we're at an impasse.
Yeah. How are we going to move forward here?
Well, I think I might have a way.
So we're in the middle of the Amazon rainforest.
This part of Brazil is where Dan Everett and his family have spent years of their life.
There is a rainy season and a rainier season, and it is always humid. The average temperature is in the 90s Fahrenheit. There are a lot of bugs. I've had malaria several times. I've taken students from around the world to work with me, and of all of those students, probably one has decided they wanted to continue to do field research.
But Everett himself has weathered the constant physical struggle of living for months on end in this jungle, all to get to know and learn from a group of people called the Pirahá. It's a community that turned linguistics on its head.
The Pirahá's way of life is still very traditional. They're hunter-gatherers. In some of the villages with the most contact with the outside, you'll find people wearing clothes. In some of the other more isolated villages, you'll still find that the women wear no clothes and the men wear only loincloths. They can't carry on a full-blown conversation in any other language but their own.
Here it is being sung and whistled. Learning the Pirahá language is what kept Everett in the jungle all those years. He's now fluent. There are three vowels. The men use 8 consonants, the women 7.
But more intriguingly to me as a linguist, and what has caused the greatest controversy, is the idea and the discovery that they lack recursion in their language.
So to understand why this is such a big deal, you need to know two things. First, obviously, what recursion is. It's the nesting of one kind of phrase inside another of the same type, like yellow, fuzzy, and soft, three adjectives strung together. Or John's brother's house, where the noun phrase brother's house is tucked inside that of John's brother's house. Second, recursion is what Noam Chomsky, again, the godfather of linguistics for decades, asserted to be the fundamental building block for all human languages and a cornerstone of universal grammar. Without it, he and those who subscribe to his theory have said you don't have language. It is, they've said, what makes human beings different from all other species on Earth, now and before. But deep in the Amazon, when Dan Everett listened to Peter Ha, he didn't hear recursion.
They don't have words like and or that would normally be used in a language with recursion. So you can't say John and Bill. You wouldn't say John's brother's house. You would say John has a brother, he has a house. So in Peter Ha, you would say,
So what's the significance of the fact that languages may differ with or without recursion in terms of understanding the origins of language?
When we find that languages spoken today have grammars far less complex than we would have anticipated, what we find is that having words and putting the words in some agreed-upon order is really all you need to have a language. And with that, you can communicate anything that needs to be communicated.
And recursion isn't necessary to do it. At this point in his argument, Everett considers the grand sweep of human history, not just Homo sapiens or Homo neanderthalensis, but what some believe may have been the ancestor of us both, Homo erectus.
They were the first human beings.
Homo erectus lived from 1.9 million years ago to perhaps 143,000 years ago. They were tall, maybe even taller than we are, and lean, 150 pounds or so. They had ape-like faces.
But still human enough so that we wouldn't have confused them with a gorilla. They would have been the best runners the world had ever seen, able to run to death just about any quadruped. If it wasn't dead by the time they caught it, it would have been dead shortly after with one of their stone axes or one of their wooden thrusting spears. Homo erectus carried these tools with them.
They sailed from the African continent to the Asian continent. The list goes on. Erectus had organized villages and burial rites, too. Everything that Everett ticks off, his face glowing as he talks, made Homo erectus pioneers. And his conclusion from all of this.
All their activities show a need for language.
Wow, that's really interesting. All their activities show a need for language. I mean, that sounds just like the line of reasoning that Philip Lieberman made earlier about Neanderthals.
Well, yeah, ish. We'll get back to that in a second.
With the evidence for organization and planning and travel and culture, Erectus would not have had that big a hurdle to get to language.
Especially if language doesn't depend on recursion.
Anything I can say with a recursive sentence, I can say without recursion, and vice versa. Language is simply symbols in agreed-upon order with context.
Okay, Ari, so the one question I had, or what I think about, is flocks of birds that somehow know or communicate to each other to, like, move in a formation, or ants that somehow can build colonies together and communicate in some way to do complicated things. And what is the difference between a flock of birds doing a complicated thing, like flying from the north to the south, and a colony of ants and humans that watch each other and build tools? Why aren't ants speaking, and why, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I know where you're coming from. I think the difference between an Arctic tern, say, and Homo erectus is that in order for erectus to have reached a series of really far-flung islands, they had to have constructed vessels to sail on and paddles to get ashore. And that level of tool production and group coordination, says Everett, necessitated language.
So it's just far more complicated.
Yeah.
It goes sort of beyond instinct?
I think that's right. It's beyond instinct. There's an element of planning, execution, coordination that's different. And from what we can tell, the birds and the ants, although their behaviors are rather complex, really aren't doing that kind of complex planning. Now, I should say that Everett's theory is by no means mainstream. Many prominent linguists find fault with it, that it's vague or nonsensical. And I should note that if Homo erectus did have language, and the jury's still out on that, they wouldn't have sounded like us at all. All we have of them is their skeletal remains. But here's Everett's theory.
They had a vocal apparatus that was roughly like a modern gorilla's. So they spoke, we simply speak better than they do because we've had hundreds of thousands of years of evolution for our speech apparatus to catch up with our language.
Yielding a throat that can kill us when a bit of food goes rogue, and that can also utter the phrase Heimlich maneuver.
Which brings us full circle.
Yes, it does.
I told you the question of where language comes from isn't settled. The debate rages on.
The more we look, the cleverer we get at this, the further ago we find this kind of really sophisticated thinking was happening.
First in Neanderthals, now in Homo erectus, possibly. The earliest glimmers of language, say some experts, keep twinkling farther and farther back. Philip Lieberman wrote me recently to say it could even predate erectus, back to at least 3.5 million years ago when Australopithecines were making stone cutting tools. But that may be a story for another day.
In the distant future. Or the distant past.
That's right, Nina. But there is one.
Oh, that's just so deep.
Yeah.
Or not deep at all.
We must be reaching the end of the podcast. But the one thing we can say for sure.
We are, in fact, talking apes.
Talking apes. Thank you, Ari.
Thanks so much, Ari.
Ah, bah.
Oh, boy. What's wrong, Elmo?
Oh, well, Elmo wants to hear music, but Elmo's radio won't work.
Oh, I think I can help you with that. Music, please.
Ah, good idea.
ABCs, ABC.
That's all for this week. Thanks to many people. Thanks, Ari Daniel. Thanks to Nova, our partner program here at WGBH. Thanks to the lovely Tina Toby. And thanks to you, dear listener. If you want to give us a comment, what do you think about the evolution of language? Hit us up on Twitter. We're at LingoPod. And catch you later.
Next time, won't you sing with me?
Okay, Indian. ABC.